lions and tigers and bears and the whole business all the way through. So we're in chapter 8 here in just a moment. Before we get started, Jeff's going to say a word of prayer, and then we'll dive into chapter 8. We're titling this lesson, Living in the Darkness, and then next week is Praying in the Darkness, because it's two times in the life of Daniel. Remember, this isn't in chronological order. This is backing up in the story, where things were going pretty poorly for Daniel, and consequently, God seems to give him a vision that is equally disturbing to help him learn how to live through these difficult moments. The first one tonight is strange, and then, as I say, next week it's a little stranger still. To explain this chapter, the best I can do, when you go on a long car ride and the kids say, "Are we there yet?" About 2 hours before we get there, I start saying yes, just because they've worn me out, right? I mean, it's. And then an hour in, he'll say, "Well, you said that an hour ago." And I'll say, "Well, we're an hour closer. What do you want?" So it's all pretty relative. If you go to a bookstore like Mardell's and look through the prophecy section, all of them tell you the end is near, because that's a lot more exciting than saying the end is far. Daniel chapter 8 is one of those rare places where you read a prophecy, and then God says, "But it's a long way off, don't worry about it." It's kind of a strange spin on what we normally see, and ought to give us pause about maybe the way we read some passages in the Bible where we're always very anxious to say, "And that's happening right now." Daniel is told, why would you assume that's the case? You know, maybe not. And is told even to hold on to things and wait till later. So we'll look at that as we dive in. Starting in verses 1 through 14, and I'm just going to read all of this together, but we'll have to break it up into pieces to get some sense of it. But I've noticed that these visions, because they're a dream, they're meant to be seen. And since I can't dramatize it for you, the best I can do is read it all together and then go back through it. Because if you look at it one piece at a time, you get lost. Every verse seems like a new puzzle to solve. And you're not supposed to read it that way. Read it all kind of together, and then you can go back and look at details as you're able, but start with the big picture. Okay, so 1 through 14. "In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. And I saw in the vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision, and I was at the Ulai Canal. I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him, and there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. As I was considering, behold, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth, without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him with his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him, and there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. Then the goat became exceedingly great, but when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and instead of it there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. It grew great even to the host of heaven, and some of the host and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. it became great, even as great as the prince of the host. And the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of the sanctuary was overthrown, and a host will be given over to it together with a regular burnt offering because of transgression. And it will throw truth to the ground, and it will act and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, "For how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state." Everyone understand all that? Okay. So it's definitely, remember, apocalyptic literature. It's odd, okay? It's like reading ancient science fiction. I mean, it's the stuff of nightmares and visions and God drawing on the deepest part of human imagination to get symbols to convey his message. So let's back up to verse 1 and then kind of work through it now that we got the basic idea of what's going on and see. We're going to be a little more specific this time because last time the angel, you remember, said, "Oh, don't bother with that stuff. Look at who wins." This time, Daniel's going to ask the angel later in the chapter for some explanation, and the angel is actually a little more helpful about telling him who's who in the picture, so we'll let the angel tell us what to think. This is the second major vision. It says this in verse 1 of chapter 8, that appeared to me at the first. So there was one in the first, in chapter 7, you're in the first year of Belshazzar, and he gets a vision. Now we're in the third year of Belshazzar, and he gets another vision, another major vision. Okay, what do we know about Belshazzar? You may remember from chapter 5 that Belshazzar was kind of worthless and didn't stick around too terribly long. Okay, but he is the last of the Babylonian kings before they're conquered by the Persians. There's a difference in setting. And not just he's dreaming, I understand that. But in the first one, he describes the dream and he said, "I was by the great sea and monsters started coming out." Well, that's not very specific. I mean, assuming the great sea is, I don't know, the Mediterranean or something, or just a great sea, where are you? There's a lot of places by the great sea where monsters come out. So I don't know what that is. Here, in contrast, he's very, very specific. He tells you what town he was standing in his dream. In his dream, he is in Susa, the citadel. Susa is the capital city. Problem is, it's the wrong capital city. Daniel is in Babylon, and Babylon is in charge. But in his dream, he is in Susa, the capital of Persia. And he's sitting in their capital. And he's even able to tell you specifically where he is. He's naming cross references. You know, there's a canal. I can name the canal. He tells you, "I'm by the bank. You know, here I am." And he's very specific about where he is. And so in his dream, he is in not the Babylonian capital city where he actually lives. He is in the Persian capital. So if you just knew that, what might this dream be about? Persia. Yeah, it might lead you to believe that God wants to tell you something about Persia, because if you have a dream, and in your dream, you're in Persia, and you know it, do you always know where you are in a dream? Have you ever had a dream where you knew exactly where you are? I mean, you could name, and you knew the number on the door and the whole business. Yeah, I mean, Daniel has a very specific location. He said, "I know exactly where I am," which is odd, because I don't have any reason to believe Daniel had ever even been to Susa. But he says, "I happen to know that's exactly where I am, and I know exactly where I am in Susa." So it's a very specific kind of dream he has. So this is a different kind of dream. The big picture of the dream is there's some kind of battle rivalry between a ram and a goat, which is interesting language. What's the difference between a ram and a goat? Yeah, I mean, sheep and goats, right? I mean, it's not, they're both critters, you know, they're both pastoral, right? But they're in the same kind of general family, but they might look similar, but they're different. okay? And you would be able to know one's a ram, one's a goat, okay? So the first creature he sees, well, I've already said this. Susa is the capital of Persia, leading us to believe it's related to topic vision. Okay, the ram has two horns, but they are lopsided. Now, I don't know if I'm supposed to make this connection, but you might remember in the last vision there was a bear, and it said that the bear was lopsided. And so that kind of makes me think that there is at least something in common between these two beings, which would lead me to believe that I now have a clue to go back to chapter 7. But I'm not in chapter 7, so I have to stay in chapter 8. The goat arrives and defeats the ram. It's a pretty short battle. Goat wins. The goat has a great horn that allows him to be victorious. He doesn't even touch the ground. He's so powerful. But then, after he wins, the great horn is broken, and four other horns take its place. And then, just when you think we're done being strange, of the four horns, one of those becomes big. And during his time, something happens to God's people. Sacrifice is stopped, the sanctuary is defiled, and it has something to do with God's people. Which is also interesting. The sanctuary is defiled. The sacrifice is stopped. In the time of Daniel, what had happened to the temple? It had been destroyed. There is no temple when Daniel has this dream. And there are no sacrifices being made in Jerusalem. But in his dream, it's happening. There is a sanctuary and there are sacrifices, but then this happens and they stop. Kind of keeping in mind the flow of events here, is the details are interesting. Well, if you're like me, you're pretty good and confused now, and so is Daniel. So, in chapter 8, verse 15, he's going to ask for help. When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it. And behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. By the way, that's always a hint. When you see someone and it says, he looked like a man. That's a subtle hint. But he had this vague suspicion that he wasn't, right? So he sees someone, he looks like a man. And he says, I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and it called, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So someone hollers at the man that Daniel sees and calls him Gabriel. Give us any hint as to what sort of person this might be? Yeah, okay, so we could kind of guess. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, O son of man, that the vision is for the time of the end. And he's going to say that repeatedly throughout this chapter. That, and Ben's take on that is, the end is far. Not the end is near. He says, settle down. This is for down the road somewhere. Not now. Not the end is near, the end is far. And when he had spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. Now, anybody Inception fans, okay? Daniel is in a dream, at which point in the dream he falls asleep and has another dream about his dream. Told you this is a weird chapter. Okay. When he had spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. And he touched me and made me stand up, and he said, behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation, for it refers to the appointed time of the end. So again, the end is far, not near. As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. Oh, isn't that great? For once in two chapters, the angel just says, here's what it is, right? I don't have to guess. Don't have to pull out a map of the Soviet Union and figure out who Tim LaHaye thinks it is today. I can just say, here it is, right? It says it's Media and Persia. And he's not done. And the goat is the king of Greece. Okay? So we have very specific references. This is not need to be reinterpreted further to modern events. It's referring to kingdoms that existed and had been warring in that period of time for quite some time and that he would know about. Okay? Media and Persia, and Greece. And even if, for what it's worth, in the sea next to Greece is the Aegean Sea. Aegean in Greek is goat. It's the goat sea, and they're the goat people. They're the Aegeans. Because if you've ever looked at Greece on a topographical map, it's all mountain. it's all hill country. So they're the goat people, and they often refer to, that's the goat sea, and those are the goat folks over there. And so it makes kind of sense that, sure, here comes the Greeks, and what are they? Well, it's a big goat. Okay. Where was I? That was 21. And the goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn between his eyes is the first king. Now, it doesn't give us a name, but a cursory look at a history book tells you that the king who led Greece to its period of greatness in the ancient world is Alexander the Great. In fact, if you can only name one Greek king, it's probably Alexander the Great. He's the one you might know about. And it would make sense that that might be the reference here, although it isn't calling by name. As for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. So just to spell it out again. The Persians are the ram. They fall to the goat, which is Greece. Greece has a horn, which is a great king. We think it's Alexander. Alexander falls, and four nations come out of his one nation. Again, turns out we have maps. At the time, well, this is still in the future. So Babylon falls to, I'm sorry, Jerusalem falls to Babylon in 586 BC. Daniel stays there for at least 70 years. So now you're down to like 516-ish BC. When you get somewhere before that, so maybe 520 is the third or fourth year of Belshazzar. Alexander the Great, you're talking about 335, 333 BC. So we're a century, century and a half still in the future that he's being told about, which is why the angel keeps saying, yeah, don't worry about it. It's far. But Alexander the Great up here in Greece, here's the goat sea. The Persians had come all the way from this area where they had taken Babylon and controlled what we call Asia Minor or Turkey. Alexander the Great marches down from Pella. Wins, beats everybody, conquers the Egyptians, takes back Jerusalem and the Holy Lands and all that weren't the Holy Lands at the time, but whatever. And then moves, makes his way all the way over to the Indus River Valley where he finds out elephants are big and he loses. But that's the story of the Greek Empire that spreads in about a 3.5 year span to cover larger and more territory than the Persians had ever thought about holding. The goat's feet never even touch the ground, right? I mean, he just comes in and he wins. But then at that point, Alexander the Great dies, and his generals, four of them, divide up the empire. Cassander takes Greece. Lysimachus takes Thrace. They're all in the Black Sea. The Ptolemies take Egypt, and the rulers in Egypt are known as Ptolemies for generations to come. The first Ptolemy I had to learn about was an astronomer named Ptolemy, also from Egypt, but not this one, because everybody in that family is named Ptolemy. And then Seleucid, or Seleucus, has the Seleucid Empire, which is this group over here that spans Persia and most of the previous territories. So, again, without getting overly technical, there's a pretty good sense that given the details the angel does give you, the direction the vision takes, and what you could find in a middle school history book, this seems to kind of match up. You could get more technical, and some people do. I've got commentaries that just go down that rabbit hole as far as you want to go. But sufficient to say, this seems to match up pretty well. This is the future of not the empire he's currently in, but the fall of the empire still to come, and then the future of that empire. So he's seeing a ways off in the future, which is why the angel keeps saying, settle down, but here's the way it's going to look. Now, what was the last bit there? That other horn, one of those four horns was going to become a problem. Remember that part? Okay, so the angel's going to explain some of that, beginning in verse 23. And at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, A king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise. His power shall be great, but not by his own power, and he shall cause fearful destruction and shall succeed in what he does, and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints. By his cunning he shall make deceit prosper under his hand, and in his own mind he shall become great. I love that line, by the way. In his own mind he shall become great. Now there's a story, if ever. That's been repeated throughout human history. In his own mind he shall become great. Without warning he shall destroy many, and he shall even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken, but by no human hand. The vision of the evenings and the mornings that has been told is true, but seal up the vision, for it refers to many days from now. So there again, how does it end? The end is far. The vision you've seen is of things way down the road. Okay? So just to summarize this section before we pick at it a little bit. Toward the end of Greece's story, Daniel's told that there will be a king who will arise who is the enemy of God's people. He will oppose the prince of princes. That's an odd phrase. Not the king of kings, the prince of princes. I think that is a description of the Jewish high priest. I would be happy for someone to argue with me because I wouldn't bet a whole lot of money on it. But my guess is the high priest. It seems to fit. This new king will ultimately be defeated, but not by man, by God. And again, Daniel's told this happened much later. Okay, so what are we supposed to take away from the story of the ram and the goat, and then this kind of second story that follows it? The message of the ram and the goat. Here's a couple, I think, basic principles. We get to wonder, why does Daniel need to know this? Why show him a vision and then immediately say, but hey, it's later on? In fact, seal up the vision sounds to me like, don't go telling people this. He's not supposed to go preach to the world, here's the end of days. Just hang on to this. It's important, but don't fret about it. Here's a couple of reasons why I think he's being told this. The wars of this world are a ceaseless cycle of rivalries. They are petty and small before God. If you worked for Belshazzar, it would be easy to think that this was the most important stuff that had ever happened, and it was all monumental and huge, and don't we do that? Whatever's going on right now, we think is the most important thing that could ever happen. Anybody remember, of course you all remember everything I say in the pulpit. Anybody remember the sermon I gave here the week before the 2016 election? I read quotations from people saying this was the most important election in history, but I read them from like the last 50 years. That every time there's an election, there's somebody who says, this one, this is the most important one in history. And I'm going to make a prophecy. You ready? In 2020, we will be told it is the most important election in America's history. Right? I bet you I'm even right about that one. Because you always feel like what's going on right now is the most important thing that's ever happened. Daniel's given a vision. And the first thing he sees is a goat and a ram fighting. If you see a goat and a ram fighting in a field, do you think that's the most important thing that's ever happened? No, you think it's what goats and rams do. I mean, they're out. If two goats are butting heads, billy goats or whatever, or a ram, and you don't think a lot of it. You think, well, that's what they do. That's how God sees human empires and their kings. Just two billy goats butting heads. They do it every so often. To him, it is not the catastrophic end of all things. It's not the beginning and end of his purposes for the world. He says, oh, it's billy goats. And one of them wins. God says, I can even tell you which one if you want. So it's not as much to get worried about. The world goes on, Daniel, long after you. Number two, God's people have much still to suffer in years ahead. Daniel, good news. You're going to survive Belshazzar. Bad news. You're not going to like the next guys. Good news. You're going to survive the Persians. Bad news. You're not really going to like the Greeks. Good news. You'll survive the Greeks and get the Seleucids. Bad news, you're not going to like the Seleucids. They're worse than the Greeks. Good news, the Romans were going to throw out the Seleucids. Bad news, nothing with the Romans ever goes well. They're going to end up killing your Lord, if we were to tell the rest of the story. So what is he being told? Again, it puts it in perspective. Oh, this is the worst thing that's ever happened. Well, it's not even the worst thing that's going to happen, Daniel. There are good days ahead and there are terrible days ahead. Let me tell you about someone who's going to come as a tyrant, and he's going to stop the very sacrifices of God's holy temple that doesn't even stand now. That tells you how far into the future we are. And yet even he falls. It's like God is telling you about a villain you don't know about yet and telling you that he's going to lose, to help you understand that what you're going through can't possibly be as bad as you think it is. Number three, while God wanted to give Daniel a sense of his place in history, he did not want to burden Daniel or others with unnecessary information. If God knows what's going to happen, why doesn't he just tell us? Why isn't there just a book under the pulpit that I can open up and it says, let me tell you who's going to win the 2020 election so you don't have to worry about it? Why doesn't he just give us all the details? Because we'd worried about that. I mean, we wouldn't know what to do with it. Daniel is told more in this vision than anybody's ever been told, and he goes crazy with it. The last verse of the chapter says, I woke up and I was disturbed. He's sick to his stomach. After the angel says, don't worry about it, it's later. We wouldn't know what to do with it. So God says, to help you understand, I'm going to give you a few pieces of the story. But no, God does not intend for us to know the future. So, what does that tell you about the book you see on the shelf that says, I can unravel the prophecies of the Bible and tell you the future? God never wanted to tell us the future. Daniel knew more about it than anybody, and the angel says, no, don't worry about it. God doesn't typically tell you a whole lot. It's not your job to comb through the Bible and find out the secrets of the future as if God hid them there. Even when he wants to tell you, he doesn't burden you with much. So we couldn't handle it. That's why he's God and we're not. He can handle the future on his shoulders as he has the past. Jesus will say it like this, sufficient for the day is the evil thereof. You humans need to worry about what you're doing right now and let God take care of what's next. Even with Daniel's insight, he cannot expect to predict future events. Daniel is a dreamer of dreams, interpreter of dreams, renowned throughout Babylon, had saved people's lives by his ability to interpret the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar, not once but twice. He has a dream and he doesn't know what it's about. So when you tell me that you found the new secret of the future in the Bible, and Daniel had his own dream, and he still has to ask an angel to interpret it for him, I'm just skeptical of you. I'm sorry. I don't believe that you get more insight than Daniel did. The future is a strange place. And Daniel says, he tried to tell me, and I still don't get it. I still had to ask the angel. And the angel told me stuff, and I still didn't get it. So if you wonder why he's been skeptical of any kind of future-facing prophecy, it's because Daniel had a few and still didn't understand them. That tells me maybe I don't need to worry about them. Okay? Now, what about that last bit? I do want to pause for a few minutes on that bit about the little horn. We do know a little bit more about this period of history, and I think it's worth mentioning. Because anytime you get to go to your computer and Google Antiochus Epiphanes, you know you're having an exciting day. And that's what I got to do. Antiochus Epiphanes, he is Antiochus IV, and he rules from something like 175 to 164 BC. He's associated with the Seleucids. So let me just go back a minute, because if you have a map, why not? So this is the section that the Seleucids ruled, the Seleucid Empire. Antiochus is associated with Syria and this area, and of course, that's where Jerusalem is, down south of there, right? He has a few wars, and he really thinks he's something. His name is Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphany literally means God made manifest. The voice of God shone to the world, right? That's a nice name to give yourself. What did that verse in Daniel say? He is great in his own mind. And Antiochus Epiphanes thinks he is the light of God among men. He is the voice of God among the people. Okay, God has made manifest his voice through Antiochus. He went to war with Egypt, and it didn't go well. And so, the sad story of Jewish history, when somebody is trying to conquer the world and it goes poorly, they blame the Jews. And so that's what Antiochus did. Antiochus went back to the country he did control and starts inflicting his indignation on the Jewish people. He banned circumcision, which is what it meant to be Jewish. It's illegal now. He stopped the temple sacrifices. So by this time, this is now a couple hundred years after Nehemiah and Ezra, the temple's been rebuilt. The Zadokite priests are offering the sacrifices again in the temple, and all this is going on. Hooray. He says, nope, no more sacrifices to your God. We probably would have won these wars if you were good Greek-worshipping people. And so he takes a pig into the temple, the unclean animal, and sacrifices it on the altar of the Lord, and then marches into the Holy of Holies and sets up an image dedicated to Zeus. Okay? Does this sound like the kind of fellow that Daniel has been described to, right? Thinks quite highly of himself. He's going to defile the sanctuary. He's going to stop the sacrifices. And then he's going to come to an end. It turns out the Jewish people had been pushed to their limit by Antiochus. And the pig was as far as they could go. Defiling the temple that they had fought so hard to have a second time was just more than they could take. And the sons of Judas rise up a rebellion. They call Judas the Hammer, which is a great name if you're going to be a rebel leader. You want to be called the Hammer, which roughly means Maccabees is the way it comes out. So this period is the Maccabean period, the time of the Hammer. And he leads a revolt, and by 164, they have reclaimed and rededicated the temple. They set up candles throughout to celebrate menorahs, and they declare a festival of lights, which from that time forward, in December of the year, is kept as a Jewish feast to remember the rededication of the temple called Hanukkah, which is celebrated to this day. And it's the story, if you ever sit in on a traditional Hanukkah celebration, they'll tell you the story. This is the only other place you'll ever hear. The story of Antiochus Epiphanes and Judas Maccabees crushing his rebellion, or crushing his reign, right? And they tell this story. So why does Daniel need to know that story? Let's assume that all this is more or less correct, and that that's what that little horn was about, that last end of the story. Why does Daniel need to know that? Well, I've got 4 points. We need to understand something about evil, and there's no better lesson to learn evil from than Antiochus Epiphanes, who is a rotten guy. He is the kind of evil. You had to go a few hundred years into the future to find a person as corrupt as Belshazzar. But God did it. He says, let me show you someone else who's just rotten. First of all, evil often rises because of the sin of the people. Look in verse 23 at the explanation. It's worded funny, but the ESV says, at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold face shall arise. That there is, God's all for free will, I do believe that. But he has a degree of patience where evil reaches a limit and has to be ended. And he intercedes in history. There's a line in one of the other passages in the Old Testament, and I'm drawing a blank, and one of you is going to remember it. But the iniquity of the Amalekites is not yet full. It's one of the prophets, or God says to the prophets, you know, let them alone. They're evil, but they're not get rid of them evil. Just wait, they will be. And it kind of hits its tipping point. The flood of Noah was a tipping point where God says, that's quite enough. Belshazzar, whom Daniel is forced to serve, is one of those tipping points where God writes on the wall, "You're done," and that night throws him out. Antiochus Epiphanes is one of those tipping points. But it has to do not with the fact that God is not in control. I think that's the point. When evil rises, does that mean God's just losing the battle? No, I think God believes in free will, and God gave us free will and wants us to make choices and see the consequences. And then when those consequences pile up to disastrous level from time to time, he pulls the reins back. That's a very watered-down version of my view of that, but that gives you an idea of it. Point is, don't blame God when bad things happen. Evil is often the result of evil. Before Antiochus, they weren't particularly good and suddenly became evil. They had been evil. That's how a person as wicked as Antiochus comes to power, is the people before him were a little less evil but tolerated it, and the people before them were a little less evil. It took all the way till the pig was in the temple before anybody rebelled against this guy. Right? And then you had to like cross the threshold of, oh, well, that's too much. But he had done a lot of terrible things before then and gotten away with it, which is why he was in power and the people before him were in power. Second lesson. Evil may attempt to trample even the stars of heaven. That's the line from verse 10. This one's going to reach up and grab the stars of heaven and then step on them. Who put the stars in heaven? Yeah, there are people from time to time who think they run the cosmos, who think they run the universe, and God has to remind them that they do not. There are people who will try, but ultimately, God remains in control of creation and history. Was that an important lesson for Daniel? Daniel must have thought that Belshazzar was ripping the stars out of the sky. I mean, he was making a mess out of the world. And he says, let me tell you a story about a fella, still to come, who thinks the same thing, that he's going to run the cosmos. He won't either. What about evil in our day? Does evil in our day sometimes think that it runs the universe? It does. And we as Christians have to remember it doesn't. And it never will. The stars are still up there. Belshazzar and Antiochus and Hitler and anybody else, none of them yanked the stars out of the sky. None of them actually overthrew the creation. None of them toppled God. And they never have and they never will. Number three, evil's triumphs are of a limited duration, whereas God's judgments are forever. Slip back a little bit to verses 13 and 14. This was the bit that I hurried through and was hoping you wouldn't notice and have questions about. 13 and 14 is where the Holy One says, well, how long will that last? And the person says, 2,300 evenings and mornings. There have been commentators who have tried really hard to find exactly 2,300 days somewhere in history and say, oh, that's it. It doesn't work real well. It's about 7 years, not exactly. It kind of fits some of the story of Antiochus. It kind of doesn't. I don't worry a lot about numerology, especially round numbers. If it said 2,331 days, I'd start looking, okay? But when it's a nice round number, 2,300 days, I say, okay. So the point is it's a limited duration, some number of days. Which is, remember, it's kind of funny the way the angels talk about time. The angel said to Daniel, well, that's many days to come. Well, on our map, it was 300 or 400 years to come. He says, yeah, that's some days off. So I don't know how they think about days and what that would even mean when he says, oh, you know, 2,300 days, thereabouts. Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10. The Christians are promised, you will have tribulation 10 days. Again, I'm sure there was somebody, Randy, who got out their calendar and said, oh, good, let me see. We're almost through this. But, of course, yeah, that's not what it was intended to mean. What it meant was, you'll have tribulation 10 days, but be faithful unto death, I'll give you a crown of life that lasts forever. What you're going through is short. What God is doing is forever. How long will the temple be defiled? Too long. 2,300 days? Too long, but not forever. When that little horn falls, how long does he fall for? He's done. He doesn't come back. Each of these get one go at it, and then they're finished. All the monsters in chapter 7 get one pass, and then they're done. Okay? So all of them have a little burst of activity, and then it's over. When you're experiencing evil in a culture, you think, it's been like this forever. Has it? And there's always been bad things, and it goes in cycles, but it comes and it goes. I bet if you lived in Germany in 1939, you thought, this is the way it's always been. And it hadn't been. It hadn't been for very long, even. And it wouldn't be for much longer. But everything seems like it's going to last forever until it doesn't. And that's the way evil goes. Daniel needed that reminder. You are going through the years of Belshazzar. Someday his time will be up. And as it turns out, we know the rest of the story, Daniel would be there to see it and to say, it's tonight. There's the handwriting on the wall, and that's what it means. You're done, pal. But at this point in the story, he didn't know all that. Finally, point number 4. When evil rises, God is already at work to defeat it. In verse 25, it says it like this. By his cunning he shall make deceit prosper under his hand, and in his own mind he will become great. Without warning, he shall destroy many, and he should even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken, but by no human hand. When evil comes into the world, it does not do so as a surprise, as if God wakes up in the morning and says, I never anticipated that might happen. Those humans outsmarted me again. Okay, that's not the way it works. When evil arises, God has already begun whatever it takes to defeat it. That's what Christians hope in. Before Antiochus Epiphanes ever was thought of, God had already plotted his demise. So what does that say about Belshazzar? Daniel, before you were ever born, the undoing of your wicked king was already in the works. So what does that tell us about the evil in our age? We think, oh, it's just going to be here forever. Before it ever happened, God had already begun working for its undoing. It may not be pleasant. None of these stories are nice. None of them leave you with a warm, fuzzy feeling in your chest. But evil, in all of its awfulness, ultimately loses every time. And by telling Daniel a series of visions of what was to come, it helped him understand the evil of his own era. Did that make everything better? Verse 28 says, no, 27 rather. And I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days. Okay, does it make everything better? No. In fact, right away he says, that's just awful news. Why would you tell me that? I didn't want to know that. But then at some point he kind of comes to grips with it. And this is how the chapter ends. Then I rose and went about the king's business. But I was appalled by the vision and did not understand it. So at some point I got up and washed my face and made my bed and went back to work. Went back to work for one of the wicked kings that was going to have to fall. He says, but I went back to work and I did what I was supposed to do. And I was sick to my stomach and I didn't understand. But I knew enough now to go back to work. Christians have to be faithful. Do I understand how it all ends? No. I know less than Daniel about our future in this country or in any of the countries of the world. Do I know who is victorious? Yes, I do. I know enough to be faithful. And that's all God has ever asked of any of us. So when you watch the news and you feel sick to your stomach, that's okay. The next day you have to get up and go to work and go be a Christian. That is all. That's what he says. That's it. We're done. Thank you.